And on the phone with us now with a look at the backcountry, I have Trent from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, Leslie. Good morning. You know, our snowpack right now is pretty interesting, and just meaning that if you go back and look at what happened in November and December, I think a lot of us can remember that we had very warm and dry temperatures. And the problem that happened then is anytime you have shallow snow, that snow becomes very loose or just weak and sugary. It kind of becomes like rock salt. And then, you know, Christmas, we had our first significant snowfall in Utah. And any time that you just, you know, you put stronger, more cohesive, dense snow over that weak, sugary, softer snow, you get avalanches. The problem with that old, weak, sugary snow is it doesn't go away very quickly. And so now this week, we've just loaded up our snowpack again across the mountains of northern Utah, and all this dense, wind-driven, heavy snow is landing on top of those buried, weak, sugary grains near the ground. And, you know, we're just still seeing avalanches throughout the range. The avalanche danger today is still at high, mainly because this little storm that's exiting our area right now is just kicking up the northwest winds. And again, it's just overloading those steep, shady slopes in our mountains, creating dangerous avalanche conditions. So, you know, our bottom line is that strong wind and heavy snow available is just making the avalanche danger high on all steep upper elevation slopes that are facing the shaded side of those slopes. Large, wide, long-running avalanches can be triggered on slopes, or they could be remotely triggered, which really just means triggered from a distance. And, you know, the user group that we see that has the biggest problem with triggering slopes from a distance are snowmobilers. So I would say if you're heading out to the western Uintas today or Logan, Ogden, and you're on a snowmobile, today is the day where you don't want to pull up into the bottom of those big bowls and park underneath steep slopes, because today is a day where you could trigger that entire slope and it can come down on top of you. So really, at the Avalanche Center, we're just saying travel in avalanche terrain is not recommended, and that basically means any slope steeper than 30 degrees or any slope where you're below that gets 30 degrees or steeper. So I'd encourage your listeners, just if you're heading out into the backcountry, to visit utahavalanchecenter.org and get our full updated forecast.
Okay, Trent, hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
KPCW News Time now, 8:12. 8:13, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City Planning Commissioners Melissa Band and Preston Campbell with their reaction to the new proposed Treasure Hill plans. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman in with a recap about last night's meeting. Finally, I'll be talking with Peace House Development Director Sally Tauber, along with Jordan Saxton, a clinical intern, with details about an upcoming outpatient group addressing reducing shame after domestic or sexual abuse. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, two seats from the Summit County Council will be on the 2018 ballot. Both of the incumbents, Glenn Wright and Chris Robinson, say they intend to run for another term. Both incumbents told KPCW this week they intend to file for re-election. Wright, a Park City resident, was elected just last year, taking the seat held by Councilmember Dave Ure. Ure resigned in 2015. Wright was filling out that remaining 2 years under the term. In November, Wright will be asking voters to be elected to a regular four-year term. Chris Robinson, a Basin resident, is aiming to be elected for a fourth time. In 2008, he was elected to the first-ever Summit County Council. At that point, he served 2 years, then he's been reelected twice after that four-year terms. It's 8:15. Well, the Park City Planning Commission met on Wednesday night. In the studio with me, I have the Chair Pro Tem, Melissa Band, along with Commissioner Preston Campbell. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Well, let's start. You guys were there, I'm guessing, both of you, at last night's City Council meeting for a joint discussion. You were not?
No. Just me.
Just you, Preston? Okay. Well, we finally got some new information out of that, basically showing total square footages of some 383,000 square feet, I think 266,000 gross square feet for the boutique hotel and about 117,000 gross square feet for the single-family homes. But let's talk a little bit about the discussion on Wednesday. One of those issues was soil. You heard from both planning staff and Craig Call, the representative from Park City 2 LLC, saying that there would not be any concerns regarding soils or water, And they compared it to the Montage, as well as the subdivision east of the Montage, known as the B2E. As I recall, there were compromised soils at Montage. So what did he mean by that?
You know, I think what they meant is that compared to some of the other larger projects in Park City, it's not really going to be an issue, meaning that we have dealt with soils pretty extensively in a lot of our projects. This isn't going to be any worse, and they don't anticipate any problems.
And that's based on some testing?
We have actually pretty substantial testing. I don't have the notes with me, but there's very toxic soils in those, in certain areas there. Again, having said, I don't know, I'm not going to guess what they meant by that, but and they didn't really get into those details right now. But again, I really think that it's just we've dealt with this before. We've done it a number of times. They know how to do it, and they don't anticipate it being a problem.
So there still will be a lot of excavation, of course, as you both know. This was a huge issue with the previous plans, version
17.2.
17.2,
right. 117.2.
That's just what it felt like. Go ahead.
I just want to add one thing about it. Not all excavation is created equal. You know, before they were talking about maybe a million cubic yards. The first stab they took at this new road, they were looking at 600,000 cubic yards, and they immediately said, that's not going to work. Let's look at another one. And so I think they're in the third iteration of roads. But even if they end up with 100,000 cubic yards, it won't be one-tenth as hard as the old one, because they're not looking at these giant cliffscapes and huge depths and lots of blasting. They're looking at scraping a road like the roads in Deer Valley or the roads in the Colony. It's stuff that we've seen before. It's not this new thing that was just going to be gargantuan. So even though the number of cubic yards might still seem like a lot, the complexity of the project is going down by orders of magnitude.
Right, and at this point, they're hoping to keep all the soils on site. If they have to truck it out to Tooele, they will, but I think they're working with pretty closely with the resort and hoping to just use it for regrading purposes.
So when do we hear about the mitigation for excavation? As you know, that was one of the neighbors' biggest concerns, you know, just truckloads of fill moving past their neighborhood.
I hope soon. I think they're planning on getting that information to us. Like everything else, it's a pretty short fuse. And this isn't a typical application because it's a settlement as opposed to a regular MPD application. So I don't know that we're going to get the answer to every single item by the 17th. But I think we'll get as much as they can give us as soon as they can give it to us.
And it's also important, I think, for everybody listening, and it's more important than it might be with the bond issue hanging out there. We've got a lot of education to do. There's a lot of misinformation floating around out there. And I think one of the biggest pieces of that is people think, oh, they're rushing this through, they're going to sneak something under the wire, and we're not going to have time to really pay attention to it. And that's not the case. All of the things that we don't have a chance to really drill down on now will be drilled down on in multiple other iterations that they have to come back for other permitting there's a subdivision plat that has to be approved. There's a rezoning that has to be approved. We have lots of more, bites of this apple to make sure that it's right.
Right. And I think the city, I can't imagine that we will be coming forward with a bond with no information. I don't think everyone who's involved right now thinks this is a great compromise and really wants it to pass. And so I think as soon as we get information, we'll be getting it to the public, and we're not going to be asking for a bond with zero information and just say, hey, trust us.
Yeah, but Preston, I mean, you're making the same argument as the applicant did just a month ago, saying that we don't need all of this information. And the Planning Commission was saying, yes, we do. And now I'm hearing you.
Let me clarify that a little bit, because I think one of the biggest issues is how large is the project going to be? And there was a net number, and then there was a gross number. That how much is back of house? Do you get 5%? Do you get 10%? There's all of these different calculations. And so what planning staff and the attorneys that are in the room hashing this out now, they're going for a gross number. That's the biggest issue to me, is how we're going to put a cap on this thing. I think the word that Andy used the other day was sideboards. You know, we're going to box this thing in and say this is how big it can get, and all the rest of those details we can work out later. And then the other thing that's really important for the listeners to know is that there's a bunch of other regulatory agencies. There's state and federal. EPA is going to be in on this. You know, they don't get a pass on working with toxic soils just because we float a bond issue or because we say you can have this many thousands of square feet. There's a lot of other stuff that they have to mitigate, and they're going to have to do that carefully. And the plan is to have all of that done before November so that everybody has good answers by then and can make a good decision.
So when we look at 383,000 square feet, can we talk a little bit about mass scale and size and just kind of give listeners an idea of what that means? I mean, again, that was excavation, traffic, mass scale and size always seemed to be a big issue for the Planning Commission prior to the settlement agreement. So in terms of mass, does that just mean the box on the hillside and the scaling means how we make that look?
Definitely. And we haven't seen that. We will. I think we're looking at probably 1 to 2 stories of parking underground. Right now, they're planning on 225 spaces for the size of hotel. However, I've heard that the applicant thinks that's overparked for the type that it would be. We'll be very, very careful about that because we don't want it bleeding into neighborhoods. We don't want it dealing with roads, but it probably is. This might be a black limousine crowd. And then 4 to 5 stories above ground. Exactly how that looks, we will be able to see soon, but it's not, I think I heard Bruce on the radio saying the other day, more like a chateau or the main building of Hotel Park City. Pretty substantial difference from what we were looking at the Woodward drawings.
Yeah, how does that compare, though, when we talk about 1 to 2 underground parking garages compared to what was being proposed before when we needed to create the cliffscapes?
Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Preston, but some of the excavation was going down 167 feet. I mean, it was massive, 4 to 5 stories underground.
There's really no comparison with the scale of this project, and that's why we're also excited about it, because we had looked at ways to mitigate what they wanted to put up there, what they had the right to put up there. And, you know, we're ending up with something that not only is going to be a fraction of the size, but it's going to be spread out in a better way. I mean, 18 houses on the hillside are going to blend in a whole lot better than a multitude of skyscrapers. And this hotel is going to be tucked up into that gulch where a lot of places in town won't see it at all. And the ones that do, it's going to look like things that are already here. It will not be this surface changing, wow, where did that come from? It wasn't here last year. People will think it's always been there. It's a huge reduction that I think everybody should be thrilled with.
Another concern, I think, as you referenced, Melissa, is traffic. I mean, has traffic been discussed yet in these negotiations?
It has, actually. We have trip generation right now at 2/3 to 3/4 reduction of what was anticipated for 17.2. So that's just how the use, basically, a single-family home, and I'm not a traffic engineer by any stretch, but the single-family homes are a much lighter use than a hotel or commercial or things like that. A boutique hotel will have some on-site commercial, but it'll be mainly for the use of the guests. I don't think we'll see a lot of people driving up that road to go for a cup of coffee. So that's a really substantial lessening of traffic for the entire neighborhood.
Intensity of use is the phrase that they've been throwing around, that the intensity is going to go way down because of the type of what's going up there. And, you know, everybody has tried, a lot of smart people, not talking about us, but a lot of smart staff and a lot of engineers have looked at other ways we can try to get the cars up there. And it doesn't look like that's on the table for now. It does look like it's going to be Lowland Empire. All the more reason why, if we can get that down by 70%, it's a huge win for everybody.
Is that what we're talking about? Down by 70%? I had heard more like 60. Yeah.
But I think it's so hard to know. And I mean, even the big question for me is, what if we did nothing? You know, the traffic's worse now than it was last year, and it was worse last year than the year before. So, but it's not the applicant's problem to fix Park City traffic. That's it's all of our problem together.
Or Park City roads. And another thing to think about, they are doing trip generation on these homes, these single-family homes, based on if someone was actually living there. And let's be honest, most of the people who are going to buy these homes probably won't. Very likely might not even rent them. So I think we could feasibly see even less than they're looking at right now.
Let's talk just a little bit about access then. So if we got on the town lift, wrote it up, we would see the hotel where? To the right of that? to the left of that? Do you get have? Can you give us some direction there?
To the right, I believe.
Yeah.
That's a good question. And I know they're not planning right now on changing the lift, but it could at some point.
And so there would be, so if you did want to go have a cup of coffee at this hotel or a cocktail or après-ski or something, would there be access then for somebody who wasn't staying there?
TBD. To be determined, that is definitely not where we're at right now as far as detail-wise. And I don't even think we really know exactly where it's going to sit. We had the ABC iterations that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. I think everybody agreed that C was by far the best. But we don't even know where the homes are going to sit right now or necessarily exactly where the hotel will be.
All of that's going to depend on the 3D model they're working on of how they can get the road cuts in, because the road is going to drive everything else. But the applicant has been very clear repeatedly that they, in their words, they, I think I'm paraphrasing, but I think they've said they want to maximize the skier experience. And what that means is obviously a house is worth more if it's ski in, ski out. So common sense says they want 18 ski in, ski out houses, and they want a ski in, ski out hotel.
Right.
So that would mean you and I could ski in and have a cup of coffee and then, you know, if it goes according to plan, you'd be able to ski back down to the town lift and then decide to get in your car or take the bus or ski or take the lift back up from there.
All right. A couple of other issues. King's Crown development, again, also off of Lowell. This is for 23 condominiums, 7 townhomes, 27 single-family lots. You had to recuse yourself, Melissa. How come?
I did not have to, actually. I chose to. And it was just a perception issue. You know, the developer and I have been friends for a long time. I don't think it would have made any difference in my decisions whatsoever. But I would rather not have anyone say otherwise. So it seemed the best option.
Okay. Commissioner Laura Susser had said that she didn't feel like it had been vetted enough and asked for more time to better understand the item. She was outvoted. Why the rush to vote then?
So I've got a lot of respect for Laura, and she's got a great legal mind and often teaches us about things that we might not have seen on an application. I think the biggest issue here, she missed one of the meetings, I think it was in November, where a lot of her questions would have been answered. And it's not the same to go back and read the minutes, as I'm sure she did, as it is to be there and feel the tone. And that application is kind of a model for what we'd like the rest of them to be. They were so thorough. They checked so many boxes. It's a fraction of what their allowed density was. They didn't try to maximize it in volume or use up all of their UEs. They answered so many of our questions right out of the gate. We didn't have to push for stuff. So that was a much easier one for us to take a look at.
Okay. And then an application with regard up to McHenry Avenue, historic residential low density zone, a building that was a duplex being turned into a single family home with an accessory apartment. Neighbors showed up during public comment asking you to reject the application. It does reduce the density, I guess, or not. Was that the concern, just more traffic?
You know, it's sixes, quite honestly. Right now, the home is a duplex and is being rented out as a duplex one side, and the applicant lives on the other side. He wants to build a garage with an accessory apartment. In order to do that, he will have to turn that duplex into a single-family home. That single-family home, by code, needs 2 off-site parking spaces, which it has. And then, of course, the parking for the accessory apartment will be in the garage. I think the concern with the neighbors, and it is a valid concern, is that McHenry is very, very tight. And sometimes the snow plows can't get through. Apparently someone passed away up there because an emergency vehicle couldn't get there in time. If there's something, a car even sticking out a little bit, then the snow plows can't get through and their garbage doesn't get picked up. So they're just really concerned that if the applicant rents out his home and there are more than the 2 cars, where are they going to park? And so, I mean, like I said, it's a valid concern. As far as we are concerned, though, and I'm sure you've heard this time and time again from every planning commissioner who's come in here, all we can do is look at the code. By code, they are allowed to do what they asked for. We did condition it pretty heavily, and that's kind of where we're at.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Can I say one quick thing about Treasure? And I said this the night at the meeting as well. I know there's a ton of concern from the neighbors. I would feel exactly the same way. I do feel exactly the same way, not even living in the neighborhood. And I know there's a lot of concern on the timeline of this thing. But when we were looking at 17.2, it was a project that we have never seen anything the likes of in Park City. Really tough to get your arms around. Right now, with this reduction, we're looking at a boutique hotel and we're looking at a subdivision plot, platting a new subdivision. We see those all the time. So, in fact, King's Crown is probably a perfect example. What did they have, 3 meetings, Preston?
By we, she means the Planning Commission, but you could also say we, meaning Greater Park City. You know, and that's the important thing. It's going to end up being something that looks like it was always there, and that's just a huge win for us.
Right, and to the point that people are worried that we're rushing it through, many of our applications for exactly this type of thing, Goldner Hirsch, King's Crown, they have 3 or 4 meetings. That's actually very typical. So I don't want people to think that we're pushing this through. We really are going to vet it as carefully as possible, but it is a different application, and it's certainly going to be less time consuming. I think we're all pretty happy about that.
Well, since you used the word, what's a boutique hotel?
Somebody brought that up. There is no definition for boutique hotel in our code, so really, again, we're going by code all the time. If we don't have a definition, I guess we're just kind of flying by the seat of our pants, and we're saying that boutique hotel is Chateau, is Hotel Park City. We may see that added to our code at some point, but right now we don't have one.
I think it's important not to get caught up with the phrase, you know, what does that term mean? It doesn't really matter. Some people might say you can't call it a boutique if it's more than 20 rooms. Others say 120. We care more about how big it looks from Old Town than what it's described as, if that makes sense.
And I think we should be careful when we talk about the Chateau in Deer Valley and the Chateau of Prey, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking about the Chateau in Deer Valley.
We are indeed. Thank you for the
Okay.
The clarification.
Thanks for your time, Preston Campbell and Melissa Band.
Thanks for helping us get the word out.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:33. Stay tuned. Conversation with Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. KPCW News Time, 8:34. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council yesterday began the process of whittling down the number of candidates interested in being appointed to the City Council to fill the vacancy left by Andy Bierman, who was elected as mayor. That was just one of the agenda items. Mayor Bierman joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with that. 15 applicants for your council seat. You got through half of the interviews yesterday. We'll get through the other half at a special meeting on Tuesday. You asked the applicants to come in one at a time and not to listen to one another, and you've also asked the media not to publicize their answers to those questions until after we're finished next week. How come?
Well, that's a courtesy to them. I think some of the applicants are concerned level of comfort if they go first. Do everybody else? We have to ask them the same questions, so does that give somebody an advantage? And this is typical with our interviews. We usually have the interviewees sit in the hallway while the other ones go through it. By law, they're allowed to sit in the room, and if they choose to, they may, but we ask them to do it as a courtesy, and every one of them was happy to comply. But we are really lucky to have so many good applicants, although it's going to make this decision very hard.
So when will council deliberate on the candidates, and does that have to be done in an open session?
Well, it's kind of a mix between open and closed. The interviews are done in open session. We're allowed to talk about some of the personnel issues in closed, but the decision will have to be made in an open meeting, and that will be on our regular council meeting. We're usually on Thursdays, but we're moving it up to Tuesday, I believe the 23rd, where we'll make our decision, make our announcement.
All right. Can you email one another, or are those actually...
No, we still have to follow all the open meeting laws and go through the regular processes. Council members can always talk one-on-one. We can discuss concerns between ourselves in that sense, but we can't have a formal conversation or even a round robin of emails and that. We're very careful not to do that.
All right. At this point on Treasure, we're talking about an undefined boutique hotel. Should we just call it a hotel?
We can call it whatever right. We want. I'd call it better than what it was.
We've got a total of 266,000 gross square feet for the hotel, and then 117,000 gross square feet for single-family homes. So what does that break down to for each home?
The homes are going to be big. That's been one of the discussion points. We're trying to come up with a maximum square foot because just like with a hotel where you've got the UEs, you also have the additional space, which isn't counted against it, which is like the garage space, the lobby, the hallways, circulation, that sort of stuff. Homes, same deal. The garages, the basements, and some of the mechanical is not counted against the home. But we're probably somewhere in the range of between a little over 600,000 square feet is what we're likely looking at when you look all in.
600,000?
Oh, excuse me, 6,000.
6,000, thank you.
600,000, okay. That would be a large house.
Yeah. Some people at the meeting, including Council Member Becca Gerber, seem pretty enthused about it. Does it look like we're buying down more than half of the density for $30 million?
Yeah, the way it works out, we actually end up buying down somewhere between more than 50%. We're paying for 50%, and the way the numbers work out, we get more like 55% buy down on this. What probably is more important, though, is its compatibility with the neighborhoods in terms of its look and feel, its height. Excavation is going to be much less, and intensity of use is going to be far less than what we're looking at. So the impacts, aside from the gross square footages and looking up at the massing, the impacts upon the neighborhoods and its ability to fit in is what I think really makes the biggest difference.
There was a question from Tom Fay. So the city plan supposes that half of the density, treasure density, is worth $30 million. Who made that land assessment?
You know, that comes from prior discussions and offers we know they've received and declined, but really it's set by the seller.
So that's saying that the property in its whole was worth $60 million or perhaps even more if it had no development on it?
Yeah, there was never an option on the table where we could purchase the entire property. They weren't interested in selling the entire property. This was a $30 million is what it costs to take one set of the partnership out and the 50% reduction in square footage. But when we brought up the topic of a full buy down, they made it very clear that wasn't possible. And if it was possible, it would be at an astronomical price.
Rich Ryman asked, even aside from paying off the $30 million bond, is Park City now a partner in this project?
No, I have no idea where Rich got that from. And he talked about it quite a bit, but that is not at all the case. We are simply, we are in our normal role, and we are working with the developer, and Rich talked about the city absorbing cost overruns, and that is not the case. We pay for our density buy-down, and then the developer is on their own with their construction costs.
So if the project goes belly up, what happens to our $30 million?
Well, we would still have the buy-down if it goes belly up. Nothing changes with that.
All right. Another question at Wednesday's Planning Commission brought up was, what is the total bonded indebtedness that we now have, combining the bonds for Bonanza Flat, walkability, open space bonds? Do we have that answer?
Yeah, let me look at this so I can make sure and get it right. Right now, the bonds that are on the books, we talked about the voter-approved bonds. We aren't getting into the debt that we've incurred through the water department that's paid through the water bills or such. But if you look at our walkability bonds and our open space bonds, I think our payment right now, we've got 7 bonds out there, and our annual debt service is $6.4 million. This would add another $1.9 million to that, but we've got, I believe, $1.5 million coming off the books within the next 18 months. So it's kind of a wash in the sense of what our annual debt service is, and within 7 years, that'll be over 50% retired. So we continue to be in a very healthy situation in terms of debt relative to value and incomes for the city.
Can you take those numbers a little bit further for me and in terms of what it would cost the homeower to
do for a primary residence, if your home is assessed at a $1 million value, many of our homes are assessed well below what their market value is. So we use that as a benchmark. I believe it's $90 a year.
And that's the assessed valuation.
If the assessed valuation is $1 million, if that's what your tax assessment says, then it would be an additional $90 per year or $90 per million of assessed value primary residence.
All right. New council member Steve Joyce said the scale of this project is not unprecedented. And is it basically a double tree on the hillside?
You nailed it. That was the example we used. The double tree is about the exact same size of this. It wouldn't be that configuration in that it's long and flat. This would be a little more stacked. The alternatives that we were looking at are more montage sized. So you can use those. Those are two properties we should all be familiar with. Next week, we will have some massing. We're certainly not going to have any final design. It's way too quick to be able to pull together renderings, but we will have massing that people can look at to see how this looks on the hillside.
Right. And any idea that we're going to see like maybe one building, or are we going to, and then plus the 18 homes? Is that?
Yeah, my understanding is this is all, the hotel is going to be contained in one building. So we're going to have one building, we're going to have 18 homes, and then we're going to have a mid station that is a small area that people can get off the lift or the guests from the hotel can get on.
The discussion also noted that we will not be using Lowell or Empire for the construction staging.
Yep.
So what road are we going to use?
Well, we'll still have to use Lowell or Empire for construction access. But in terms of all the staging, the loading and unloading and such, that's all going to be done up on the private roads. And we've also talked about a flat area where the mid station will go will likely be used as a staging area to store materials so they can be brought in during off hours and minimize the traffic during peak times. And then they can pull from those for construction. But the impacts are really going to be on the hotel and the 18 residences. They're going to be the ones seeing the biggest impacts of the construction. So they're going to be motivated to manage that. And then we've been talking a lot about this road. The road is sort of our remaining crux. I think we've worked through most of the issues here, but being able to minimize the hill cuts on that road and getting a safe angle on that road so that it'll be approved by the fire district are what we're working through right now. But one piece of good news is the applicant has agreed to make it a private road, meaning a gated road, if we wish. And I think that's going to leave some of the fears by the residents that it's going to draw public traffic up there for the hotel or for any restaurants or even to park for trailheads and that. There will be public access through there on foot or on bike, but likely not by vehicle.
So the hotel would be behind the gate as well?
Yes. That's what we're talking about. It hasn't been finalized, but the property owner is willing to do that.
Park City in the past really doesn't like gated communities, so I'm just curious how you guys are leaning on that at this point.
Well, there's been a lot of concern expressed by the neighbors that this will generate additional traffic above and beyond the residences and the hotel, that people will go up there for commercial uses or recreational uses, and that would put that fear to rest.
You use the trails a lot back there, the Sweeney Switchbacks, yeah. Flat Cable. Do those all go away?
No, I think there are going to be some impacts, and it makes me a little sad. I literally probably 5 days a week go up there on my bike or with my dog, and we've enjoyed it for decades being open and free, and I think a few of those trails are probably going to have to get relocated, but there will absolutely be a comparable trail system put back in, and maybe we can fix a few of those. A few of those have gotten really worn out and eroded and difficult to ride, so hopefully we'll add to it.
What's the deadline now? I mean, are we still talking about a January 17th? I had always thought it was a January 23rd decision.
Well, let me address that because it's interesting. When Mayor Thomas and I brought this to the Planning Commission, we took a lot of criticism from the community and a few of the planning commissioners that this was a stall tactic by the applicant, and they wanted us to, you know, vet it and move on, give them the opportunity to vote if it wasn't working out. So now the criticism we're taking is that it's moving too fast. So I take that as a positive sign that the public and the Planning Commission view this as viable and really do want to get it right, as do we. There's been real benefit. We agreed to the timeline because that's what the applicant requested and that's what the Planning Commission requested. And there's been real benefit to having a short timeline, and that's kept everybody motivated to move forward and reach the compromises we have. That being said, we aren't as far along as we'd like to be. We've got a lot of the information to the Planning Commission. I think next week we're going to have most of the remainder that they want. But we asked the applicant last night, and they said they might be willing to do a short extension if needed. So I still expect us to wrap this up pretty soon, hopefully by the end of the month or the start of next. But if we aren't feeling comfortable that we've pinned down everything we need to, it sounds like we might have a little wiggle room and be able to extend it for a meeting or two.
Does that continuation cost us any more than the $6
million? No.
Let's see. Anything else you wanted to add about Treasure before we move on?
I'll just say I'm really happy with the progress. I came into this as a skeptic, and I think what we have on the table is something that would be much better for our community. I've really been pleased by the response of the Planning Commission. They are so wrapped up in this and so versed in all the facts. I look to them to see if this is better than what they feel like they could have seen as an outcome. And I've heard from almost every one of them that they think this is a far better outcome and a lot of encouragement to bring it home. So I hope that everybody continues to keep the spirit of compromise moving forward and we can come up with something that finally puts this to rest for the community.
All right. During council comments, Councilmember Tim Henney said that the paid parking system has been a success. Blake Vonsbeck, I think, described it as relative success. I guess success for whom?
Well, I think it's a very complicated system that got rolled out at a very busy time of year. So we've had some glitches. We've had areas we know we need to improve upon. But all in all, we've been getting positive feedback, and we feel like it's reducing traffic. It's making parking available to the customers, and the employees are getting used to carpooling or using the alternative lots. So I would something this complex and this important to the town moving forward with positive momentum, I would say that's an early success. We'll continue to evaluate it. It may be changed and maybe it'll take a different turn, but right now we're real happy with the progress.
With regard to the Homestake lot, that changes come Sundance. It'll be used for the Sundance parking. Right now we're seeing 70 to 100 cars per day, the busiest back in December. I think it was 225 spots that cars that can be park there. Some concern that the Homestake lot will fill up early. Is that just because of people like me, day workers that use the China Bridge garage now will have to be using something else, so I don't have to pay the $40 a day?
Well, I think everything fills up during Sundance, so it's always a concern just because there's so many additional people in town and it's all hands on deck in terms of our businesses and employees. So right now the lot's been, I think at Christmas, it was we saw a lot of use in there, but it wasn't anywhere near to capacity. I think we were seeing about 70 cars in there. I think it can hold three times that. So I'm pretty confident it'll work through Sundance. We'll monitor it, but it seems to be working out well.
What about the safety issues that some people have expressed?
Yeah, it's interesting because I went over and looked at it myself, came by about 11 o'clock one evening during the end of the holidays, and it was busy. I mean, there were a lot of cars there. It was very lit up, extremely light, and there was a police car sitting at the entrance watching things. And then the next day I picked up the paper and there was a story from a Main Street employee that said, it's dark, it's unsafe feeling, and I won't use it. And I'm kind of wondering if she went to the right lot because it just didn't fit at all what I'm seeing over there in terms of a description. So going a step even further, the shuttle drivers are dropping off and picking people up at their cars and watching them get in those cars. So we are doing everything we can to assure safety. And frankly, I don't see how it's less safe than if somebody were walking up to Sandridge or walking through Sweet Alley to get to their parking. So we're doing our best there, and we encourage any feedback if there's something we can do better. But I feel pretty good about what we've set up.
And in terms of dedicated bus lane during Sundance, I mean, we've got the one going to happen on 224. But any others like Deer Valley Drive, Kearns, Bonanza? I mean, you do something like that and people are going to take the bus.
I know. That is a weakness of ours right now, is we don't have dedicated bus lanes on those feeder points. And I think that's why we're talking about moving the main transit center into Bonanza Park, into the center of town, where it acts as an effective hub and things don't get jammed up on these narrow streets. So we don't have any special plans for those at this point. We certainly are going to have the police at the intersections and maybe they can help the buses get through. But we're all just going to have to be patient and hopefully we can push people to not bring their cars into town. That'll solve it if we can just retrain everybody.
And finally, just you approved the plan for the Respect Rally happening on January 20th, the first Saturday of Sundance. How many thousands of people are we expecting?
Well, this continues to grow. It started out, the application was for 500 to 1,000. Then it had grown to 3,000. And last night we heard from the applicant it could be as many as 5,000. And I think this is a great event. It's nice to honor our free speech and do it. It's just a little unfortunate it's on our busiest day of the year. So we are planning some really aggressive mitigation on this. We're going to be busing people in, and the applicant has gone to great lengths to encourage people to take those those buses. So we'll see how it goes, but I'm just going to urge patience. And, you know, it's the beauty of a democracy that people can do these, they can host these First Amendment events, and I'll be there. I'm excited about it, but it is definitely going to be an inconvenience for the town.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I do want to mention that we have extended the applications for planning commissioners to January 26th. So if you're interested in serving on planning commission, please come throw your name in. And I also just wanted to offer out a congratulations to the Parksey Institute. They are celebrating 20 years of the Eccles Center.
Okay. Andy, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now. 8:53, good morning. Well, Peace House will start a new outpatient group February 1st for a 12-week session. In the studio to tell us more on who this is for, I have Peace House Development Director Sally Tauber along with Jordan Sexton. She's a graduate student at the University of Utah. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Sally, maybe just give us an overview of the 12-week program. We're doing this.
We sure
when
are.
And where? And
Actually, what we would like folks to do if you're interested in participating is to call the number that we're going to give you here. And there is a very short screening before you're accepted into the program. But it is noon to 1:30. And we will be meeting somewhere in town, so it's easy for people to get to. So the whole idea was really to do it over the lunch hour so folks didn't have to get babysitters.
Okay.
So if there's an organization out there who wants to donate lunch, give us a call.
Oh, yeah. That would be awesome.
All right. It's going to happen on Thursday afternoons.
That's correct. 12 to 1:30.
And it's based on, Jordan, maybe you want to take it over.
Sure.
In terms of, it's based on Brené Brown's 12-week shame resiliency.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes. So
what does that mean?
Connections. The group is called Connections. And Brené Brown, Dr. Brené Brown, is really the shame and resilience guru. She's done a ton of research on what shame is, how it impacts our lives, how we carry that shame, and what it means in our lives, and then how to learn tools to be resilient. So part of the group will focus on learning about shame, learning about how shame is, you know, impacting your life. And then the other part of the group will be learning about resilience tools like empathy, how to use empathy to overcome shame and make connections with people, because shame can be actually quite isolating. We turn inwards when we're feeling shameful and we isolate from others. And so that's also the benefit of holding it in this group and learning about shame in a group setting, because we're able to connect and relate with others and learn that we're not alone in this experience.
Yeah, and we heard from like Monica Lewinsky last weekend just how shame is one of the most intense emotions there is, even more so than anger or joy. And can you talk maybe just a little bit about the psychological effects of shame? I mean, you talk about just the fact that you're alone, but
so what shame is really, if I could just simplify it for you guys quickly today, shame is when something bad happens, internalizing it and making it about you. So shame is, I am bad. This bad thing happened, that means that I am bad. And it can turn someone inward so that they're not reaching out for help, so that they're not looking outside themselves and learning from an experience. Whereas guilt is a learning experience. Let's say, like, I am bad. Shame is, I am bad. Guilt is, something bad happened, but where can I learn? But shame prevents you from being able to learn from that experience.
And I think what Dr. Brown has always said is that shame cannot live with compassion,
right,
or empathy.
Right. Because if you're compassionate and for yourself and others, you're able to forgive. But with shame getting in the way, it cuts that off.
So are you helping to lead the program?
Yeah, I will be one of the facilitators as well as two other Peace House staff.
All right. And is this part of your graduate studies?
It is.
Yeah.
Yep. So I'm excited to be with Peace House and to be offering this group to the community.
All right. And again, I mean, when we think about somebody who would attend, I mean, it's multi-age, both
genders.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Shame affects everyone. I think it's an experience that everyone can relate with, but we necessarily don't learn the tools to overcome it. Just because of who we are, Peace House, and the clients that we serve and the experience that we serve, it will be predominantly female. But that doesn't mean that men should not, if they are interested in learning more about this group, give us a call.
Okay. What's the number to call?
So the number to call is 435-658-4739, extension 103. If you leave a message with your contact information and that you're interested in the Connections group, we'll call you back and just make sure you're a good fit for this. We encourage people with domestic violence, including emotional abuse and abuse and neglect in childhood and sexual assault victimization history.
Okay. Real quick, Peace House also hosting a flash mob during Sundance. Tell me about that.
We are. Yes, we are creating awareness for human trafficking, as January is Human Trafficking Month. Mm. And so we will have a flash mob at the bottom of Main Street on Friday, the 19th of January at 3:45. And so come cheer us on for awareness of human trafficking. And we are doing a lot of training about that here in town, along with ways to recognize domestic abuse, domestic violence. And we're doing that with the bartenders and the caterers here in town. So, yeah.
Okay. So you guys got a permit then to close the street, or?
We are not closing anything. You have to be there to find out.
We're going to be in and out. They can't catch us.
Flash.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I think that's it. We're just happy to be here. Thanks for having us, Leslie, and thanks to the community for supporting us.
Absolutely. And if you'd like more information on what Peace House services Peace House provides and more information about the group, you can also visit us on www.peacehouse.org.
Okay. Jordan and Sally, thanks.
Thanks,
Leslie.